I'm going to take that as a compliment, but I hope I look better than 9-9. But good afternoon, everybody. I'm Christian. I'm an alcoholic. I'm a very proud member of the Evans Group here in town. And I tell you, it's a real treat to stand before everybody and see all the smiling faces and feel all the energy of this many AAs gathered together. And it's also been a real treat to host our speaker today, Lee. Lee comes to us from Lake Mary, Florida, and being his host, I've had an opportunity to spend a little time with him today and last night, too. And you're going to see, as I've seen since I've spent time with him, that Lee exudes energy, happiness, and the promises of the AA program. With that in mind, would you please join me in welcoming our speaker this afternoon, Lee.
Hi, everybody. My name is Lee, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Lee.
And I really do appreciate being asked to come and participate in the 47th Georgia State Convention. And thank you very much. I appreciate the committee. I agree with Don. What a basket. Boy, I got to my room. There was a tremendous basket of fruit in my room. It took me nearly 40 minutes to eat it. Then I saw this badge, you know, and I've been to a few of these deals, and I've never quite seen a badge like this badge before. And to be honest with you, my first reaction to this was I knew I was going to have to alter it some. And I started on it. I was going to modify it somewhat, and a voice came into my mind that said, "Don't you do it." So I had to work my program to actually put this badge on today, and it's really an act of humility that I'm wearing it. I was in the elevator. G and I ate last night late, and there was a lady in the bar. When I got on the elevator, after Gina, I dropped her off at her floor, went on to mine. That lady from the bar was in the elevator with me, and she asked me what mighty task I might have performed to come in second place. So, for your committee next year, I want to suggest that you give the speakers blue ribbons. David A. said there's three kinds of alcoholics: drinking alcoholic, sober alcoholic, and dead alcoholic. And that today I am a sober alcoholic. And I know there's no doubt in my mind that the only reason that I am sober is because of a program called Alcoholics Anonymous. I tried everything that I ever heard of. When I drank alcohol, I could not control the amount of alcohol that I would drink. And when that caused me enough trouble, I quit forever. And I couldn't quit. And I was licked. And I could not stop by myself. And Alcoholics Anonymous has given me full provision, a complete program that I know that can keep me sober for the rest of my life. And I love Alcoholics Anonymous more than anything. And I love you. And I can't make it without you. And I just am so grateful to be here. My sobriety date is November the 20th, 1984. And I did not pick that date. I would have picked a better date than that. But I would have picked Christmas or something like that, you know. The 4th of July. But who picked their sobriety dates? We don't get to do that around here. I picked a bunch of them, and they just didn't take, you know. My home group is the Central Orlando Group, downtown Orlando. We meet on the highway, on the corner of Highway 50 and Broadway in downtown Orlando. There's 31 meetings a week if you're ever in that area. Our number is listed. You can call there, get directions. A lot of times you can get a ride to the meeting if you need one. We have a hotline number that's listed. So if you're in that area, please call the hotline, AA's number, and get down to the central group. You'll be blessed. Just to give you an idea of my home group, the character of my home group, I was down in Vero Beach a couple of years ago, and someone brought up the topic, the gifts of sobriety. And the first lady shared, and she said, "Serenity, boy," and talked about how great it was to have serenity and peace of mind and be able to relax and just be calm and be happy with herself and find contentment with that. The next guy shared, and he said, "Integrity," and how good it felt to be able to hold down a job and meet his commitments and The other guy shared and said fulfillment and how much it meant to him to be of service today and actually mean something in other people's lives. And so I said, boy, what a great topic. When I get back to the Central Group, I'll bring this topic up. And so the first opportunity I had, I was at the Central Group, and I said, we're going to talk about the gifts of sobriety. And the first little lady over here said, teeth. Guy over here said, early parole. Fellow over here said, pants. The one next to him looked at him and said, dry pants. So you would love the Central Group. And I certainly fit in there. Christian's been a good host. He's there when I want him, and he's not there when I don't want him. He's left me alone all morning. I went out by the river. I sat down. I got really quiet and had an opportunity to pray and look across the river. There's something about a river to me. And I know that there's another kind of river. And I know that that river flows through the middle of Alcoholics Anonymous. And in that river, there's a power. And I'm here today because that power has changed my life. It has taken me and transformed me into another human being, a different person than I ever was before. And if you're new and you're in this room tonight, there's hope for you. If you're breathing, there's hope for you. And don't give up. Don't let anything come between you and doing the things that are suggested in Alcoholics Anonymous. Don't let anything stop you. Let nothing stop you. You do it and you keep coming and you'll get this thing. I had a problem a long time before I ever took a drink of alcohol. I had a thinking problem long before I had a drinking problem. My earliest thoughts in life when I was a child would be laying in bed at night, having imaginary conversations with a kid at school, trying to practice these conversations. And I would say this. I would practice this and say something. I said, man, if I say this, maybe they'll say this back to me. And then I'll be able to carry on this conversation. And I would get to school and I'd practice these things and try to carry out this. And sometimes it would work and sometimes it wouldn't. I never did feel like I fit in anywhere I'd ever been. I was someone that felt less than inferior to and fearful of everything, everybody around me, all of my life. And, you know, today I recognize that as complete obsession, just obsession with me. And I have an answer for that today. You know, I have an answer here in Alcoholics Anonymous, a way that I can get out of myself and be with others and be comfortable with others. You know, we were talking about it at dinner last night. When I walk into a room of people, I look for someone's hand to shake or something to do for someone else. And immediately I feel a part of that group, whatever it is, whether it's in business or here in Alcoholics Anonymous or anywhere. So we have tools that work. And I didn't have that then. I had no tools. There was always some kid around that was just perfect in every way, always dressed nice, looked appropriate. The teachers all loved them. Had blonde hair. I would just hate this kid's guts and would pinch and be mean to him. Now, that never changed. And when I was in junior high school, you know, I played sports. I played basketball, baseball, football, ran track in an effort to try to fit in with a group of people and be a part of. And, you know, I was born big so I could play sports and stuff like that. They used to teach me and tell me, Lee, you were born on the 18th and 19th and 20th of June, you know. So I could play sports. I was always good. And I lettered in all these sports. I know I came in third place in the state event in a 440-yard dash and fourth place in a 20-mile marathon once. Our football team went all conference. You know, there were some accomplishments there, but it never meant anything to me. It was not sufficient to overcome this problem I had with myself. And there was always some guy on the team that was perfect in every way. He never dropped the ball, always got the girl, was very nice, always dressed appropriately and looked nice, said the right thing, had blonde hair. I just hate this guy's guts. And I'd beat him up any chance I got. When I was about 15 years old, I became very interested in girls. And there was a girl in our neighborhood that I was just nuts about. Now, I grew up with my grandparents. My mother and father had a lot of problems. I've lived long enough to make a lot of the same mistakes that they made. And I understand that so much better today. But at that time, I lived with my grandparents. And when this little girl would come home, she was 2 years older than me and had a car, I would peep through the window and watch, you know, and I would see her drive up in that car. And if I could, oh boy, she'd get out of that car and I'd watch her. She's so good looking. I love her so much, you know. She was a cheerleader. She had those pom-poms and was running in the house. And I, wow, you know, I'm going to talk to her one of these days. I'm going to tell her I love her and we're going to be happy and she's going to love me. And boy, it's going to be great. You know, we would be at school. I'd be talking to a buddy of mine at school. We would just be standing there talking and she would walk in the room and she'd walk right over next to me. And I could just kind of, out of the corner of my eye, kind of see her skin, you know. I could see her hair. I could smell her. My mind would start racing. I couldn't think. I couldn't breathe. I'd have to run out the door, you know. I couldn't stand to be, you know, that close to her, you know. We'd have these dances after ball games in the gym. And I'd be there, and I'd be watching her there at the dance. I'd see her. Oh, there she is. Tonight's the night. I'm going to tell her I love her. And she's going to love me. And we're going to walk outside. We're going to go under the bleachers. And boy, it's going to be great, you know. And she's going to love me. Boy, it's going to be wonderful. And I'd say, I'm going to ask her to dance. And that song would end. I'd say, well, after the next song. After the next song, I'll ask her to dance. And I'd wait. And then that song would end. I'd say, well, maybe after the next one. I'd be standing there, and some guy with blonde hair would come over there and ask her to dance. Screw the whole deal up for me. And that would be my life today. You know, nothing would have changed for me. I would still be living and feeling that way today, I'm sure, except for one day when my grandparents were gone, a fantastic and wonderful thing happened. A buddy of mine came over when they were gone with two bottles of Boone's Farm Strawberry Hill. And I drank one bottle and he drank the other one. In a matter of 10 minutes, I was standing out on the roof of my grandparents' house screaming out my declaration of love, you know, for this girl. All that fear was gone. I felt like I was 10 foot tall and bulletproof, omnipotent, you know, and that's the way I always wanted to feel. Alcohol took me to exactly how I wanted to be instantly, and I loved it. And I made it a point to drink alcohol every opportunity I had since then. When my grandfather came home, he drugged me off the roof and put me in bed. When I came out of that the next morning, I said, oh boy. And, you know, the guys I hung out with and we went to school with and stuff, we would pool our lunch monies in the morning, and you could get a case of Boone's Farm for $7.20, you know. And we would start drinking on that immediately before school. You know, why wait until evening to feel so good, you know? Hide it in the lockers, under the seat of the car. And I immediately started having a lot of trouble, you know. You just don't get to be in high school and drink that way and just stay out of trouble. And I drank a lot, and I loved it. And I thought it was a compliment. People would come to me and say, boy, you sure do drink a lot. And I'd say, oh, thank you, you know. I had an unquenchable thirst from alcohol. I had an unquenchable thirst for alcohol from the very get-go. Alcohol, I don't know when I became an alcoholic. I added alcohol to my body, and I had an unquenchable thirst for alcohol. I loved to drink alcohol, and I could drink. But I'd lay out 2 or 3 days at a time and drink as just a young child in school. And my grandmother would worry about me. And many times I would come home and my grandmother would, we'd sit on the couch together and she'd throw her arms around me and say, Lee, why do you do the things that you do? Why do you drink the way you drink? Why don't you call us? We just want to know if you're alive or dead. And, I'd say, Grandma, that's it. I'm never going to do it again. It's those guys I'm hanging out with, there's drinking's what's getting me drunk, you know? And that's the end of that. You know, and it'd be okay for a couple of days. First day'd be okay, second day'd be okay. On that third day, I'd be pacing the floor, back and forth, back and forth, back and forth. Walk outside and walk around the house 10 times, come back in. My grandmother'd say, well, Lee, can I fix you a sandwich? Are you hungry? I'd say, get off my back. You know, stop watching me. You're smothering me. You're driving me crazy. How do you ever expect me to have anything or go anywhere in life with the way you treat me? And boom, I would just blow out the door. And I did not know that I was reacting to an obsession. I did not know that when I left that place that alcohol was where I was headed, and I would drink, and alcohol would cure that madness. And the guys I hung out with, they wanted to drink the way I wanted to drink, and we didn't care where we got the money. And so we would steal. When we first started stealing, you know, the men in my family, they did not steal. The men in my family worked. That was not my example. They worked and took care of their family and were responsible. But we would steal. And when I first started stealing, I felt real bad about it. But later, you know, we'd steal. And I said, well, you got to steal, you know. If you want to drink, you got to steal. But still later, I just loved it. And I wanted to steal something from everybody. And, of course, when I was 16 years old, I was in juvenile court. My grandfather heard about that and said, oh, my God, we've got to help that boy, you know. And when I was 17 years old, I was in civil court. My grandfather heard about that and ran down there. Oh, my God, what are the neighbors going to think? But when I was 18 years old, I'd walk down that road where my grandparents lived. My grandfather would see me run inside the house screaming at my grandmother, oh, my God, he's coming back. You know, and he'd grab his tools and his guns and start locking those things up and hiding those. My grandmother would grab her purse and her jewelry. By the time I would hit the door, my grandmother would be clutching her purse to her like this, and my grandfather would be standing with his arm over the portable television set. And that was the last place I would ever go. I would go there when I was just sick and tired and hungry and dirty. And I knew my grandmother would feed me and try to take care of me. I drank until I had to get sober, and I stayed sober until I had to get drunk. And that's my story with alcohol. It was always that way. And I don't know why, at such a young age, alcohol did that in my life, but it did. And I've met many, many, many others that it's that way with. I go to a meeting on Wednesday nights in the halfway house, men that are close to my age or even younger, young men, 22 years old, and they've been drinking for 7 years and 8 years, just the same way I've been drinking. When I was 19 years old, I caught my first prison bit. You know, I expected it. Everyone expected it, you know. But I wasn't ready. You know, I thought I was ready. I had had a few fights in those alleys, and I thought I was pretty tough, but I was green. I was very green. They had a song written about this place, pretty popular back then, Longline Rider. There's a farm in Arkansas, some secrets in its floor, where one day the ground coughed up some roots wearing denim shirts and boots, where they'd found those bodies of all those men. 2 weeks before I got there, they'd had a riot. Guys had busted out of the hole and taken over the prison, taking some of the Free World guards hostage, had them wrapped in chains, were beating them. Finally, other inmates rescued those guards from those inmates and saved their lives. And the state troopers and sheriffs and all those old farmers with the rifles and shotguns gained back control over the prison again. Oddly staffed facility. I've been in several. I've never seen one like this one. They take these guys that were in there for murder and had a lot of time and stuff like that. They give them a rifle and shotgun, make a guard out of them. And the ones that were a little too crazy to give guns to, they'd give them clubs and make them floor walkers. And every so often I'll hear some tough guy around somewhere say something like, boy, if anybody down there ever messed with me, I'd just whip their butt. Well, guess what? That wasn't the game down there. They weren't playing whip your butt. And I made a fantastic discovery. You could get anything you want in there. And alcohol does the same thing in there that it does out here. And I got it together with some guys that I'd known on the streets, and that's how I spent my time. I drank alcohol, we made alcohol, and we did anything we had to do that. Many times I said to myself, if I ever get out of this place, I'm going to get a job. I'm going to be the man that my grandfather is. So I'm going to make everybody proud of me. And I meant that with everything in me. And the day that I got out, my grandparents came and picked me up. And we were driving down the old highway together. And I could not have been happier. I was filled with joy. I was out. I was free. I knew I'd never have to have that experience again. I was going to go on with my life. This was it. You know, I've learned my lesson. And I looked down at the old highway, and they had the stripes down the middle of the road. And I looked down at those stripes, and I could not remember what those stripes meant. I said, I know those stripes mean something. And I would think, what do those mean? I know they mean something. I'd completely forgotten, or I had no recollection of anything like that on a road before. And just one thing after another like that was happening. My second day out, I hooked up with a pint bottle of Jose Cuervo. 2 weeks later, I was with the same guys doing the same old things. And 2 months later, I was back in again. And you can take the next 12 years of my life and just stick them in the garbage can. Because I was in and out and in and out and in and out and in and out. Every time I got out of jail, I thought I was free. Every time I got out, I said, I'm never going back. I just want to be a regular guy. I just want to have a job, have a car, live somewhere, have some clothes, maybe go to school, have a girlfriend, what anybody in this world can have. But I would get out and I'd start drinking, and I was back in before I knew it. And I was clueless. I was absolutely clueless. I knew nothing about alcoholism. Alcohol wasn't a problem for me anyway. Alcohol was a solution. Alcohol would help me stay together. It helped me forget. It helped me keep going, pull together another day. I took a job on the river as an answer to the way I was drinking. 30 days on, 15 days off. I made it 28 days. I wanted to kill everybody on that boat. I'd go in my quarters. I'd sleep with a pipe. I'd say, if anybody comes in here, I'll kill you. I'll kill you, you know. And I jumped the boat at 28 days and called those people back 2 weeks later and just begged them for that job, and they would not give it to me. Someone suggested, we always got these people who want to help us. Someone suggested, Lee, what you need to do is get married. You find you the right woman, and she'll sell you down. And believe it or not, this is hard to imagine, I know. Believe it or not, there are women who are looking for guys that drink a lot of alcohol, don't have a job or a car, and sleep with pipes, you know. And I found me one of them. And she broke 13 pairs of glasses right off of my face the first 18 months we were married. She'd never heard of Al-Anon. She was more like an alligator. And I'd get a job, and I'd say, I'm going to hold down this job. I'm not going to miss a minute. I'm going to make it every day. And I'd go into work, and I'd say, this is it. I'm going to stick with it. Boy, and I'd fight my way in there, and I'd hang in there, and I'd work all week. and I'd get a paycheck. And boy, there's something special about Friday drinking. I said, I'm not going to do it again, honey, you know, and I'd go out and I'd drink. And I'd lay out 2 or 3 days and try to get that job back, try to hold down that job, get another job, make it until Wednesday, hump day. Now I'm not going in that bar to get drunk. I'm just going to have a couple. I just want to unwind. I'd have 1, 2, 3 I'd never remember 4. And she wouldn't understand these things. I know one time I was speaking with her. I said, honey, I know I haven't been the best husband, but I want you to know one thing. I'll never abandon you, you know. So she packed all her stuff and left. I moved all over. I moved all over the United States. Somebody said, Lee, go somewhere. You know, go somewhere else. Get a fresh start. And I said, that's it. Happiness is Arkansas in the rearview mirror. You know, and I went to Michigan. I went to Oklahoma. I went to New York. I went to Texas. I went down to Florida. And first couple of times I moved, I knew that it would be better. I knew it would be better in Michigan. You know, I knew it would be. But the last couple of times I moved, I didn't expect it to be any better at all. I just had to get out of town. I went to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous in New York City. My wife had left me. Most wives, when they leave to go to the other side of town, will move in with their mother or something like that. She wasn't planning on coming back. She went all the way to New York. And I found out where she was, and I called her, you know, and I said, baby, you know, when she first left, I'd say, good, you know, get lost. Who needs you? You know, but a couple of weeks later, I didn't have any money. I didn't have any gas. You know, I didn't have any food. I didn't have anybody to take care of me. Boy, I'd really start missing her. And I called her up and said, baby, you know, we can't throw away this love we've got, you know. You know, at that time, love was somebody to take care of me, you know. I know a little bit more about love today, but, man, I needed her. I needed that woman. And she said, if you come up here, you're going to do what I tell you to do. I said, anything. You know, I jumped in my car, and 23 hours later, I was in New York. I jumped out of my car, ran into the building, I grabbed her in my arms. I love you, I love you, I love you. We're going to be so happy. It's going to be great. She said, Lee, if you stay here, you're going to have to go to AA. I said, you rotten witch. How are we ever going to make it with your attitude? You know? That's how I got to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. It was in the basement of a church, kind of like this. There's just not this many people. It was just like this. Guy was standing up there, walked in, guy was standing up there talking. I knew he was a liar the second I saw him because he had blonde hair. I wouldn't listen to that guy at all. But after the meeting, two men came over to me and talked with me and tried to reach me. And they talked about their drinking. And they talked so openly, you know, that I started to share some about my drink. And, you know, all my life, all I'd ever heard from everybody I ever knew in my family was, Lee, we don't understand, we don't understand, we don't understand, we don't understand, we don't understand. And I was talking with this guy, and he stopped me and said, Lee, we understand. And I had never heard anything like that before in my life. And it scared me when that guy said that. And I took a couple of steps back, and I listened to this guy talk about Alcoholics Anonymous. And he said that his family, they were together, and they were happy, and that he was working, and all these wonderful, wonderful, wonderful things about Alcoholics Anonymous. And I told this guy, things have got to get better for me, because they just cannot get any worse. And boy, I was wrong. And I did not know that this was a progressive illness, and that it always gets worse. I wound up down in Florida. I got a job that lasted 2 weeks. That was about my max at that time. They just couldn't understand why I was in the bathroom 8 o'clock in the morning drunk and puking. They did not understand me. The last 3 years of my drinking, I know it's only by the grace of God that I'm here at all. I cannot tell you how many times emergency vehicles came out. I have a hazy memory of flashing blue lights or red lights. Somebody picking me up off the ground, my head busted open, or police trying to straighten me out somehow. The last 3 years of my drinking, I did everything. I tried it all. I checked into a hospital once. I begged these people, please take me, please take me. I didn't have a nickel's worth of insurance, and they took me in that place anyway. 3 days later, I was kicking that nurse's desk, cussing her out. You better let me out of here right now. I walked out of that place, got as drunk as I could get. My wife took me to a minister who prayed for us and counseled with us. We went to this big, huge crusade deal. We went 3 nights in a row. And I sat in the back of the top balcony all 3 nights. And at the end of each one of those services, they said, if anybody here wants God's help, God wants to help you. If you come down here, there'll be somebody to pray with you, and we know God can help you. And I would make that trip from the back of the top balcony all the way down the front all 3 nights. And I wasn't trying to fool my wife or con anybody or anything. I meant business. I went down there because I knew I needed help. I was desperate and I wanted somehow something to help me. But I was drunk in a very short time anyway. I saw a psychiatrist. I paid her $55. I told her the truth. I told her about my drinking. I told her about the violence in our home. I talked about my illegal activity. God, everybody knows you don't tell them that stuff. And she said, okay, 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 no problem. You call me next week, make an appointment. I'll see you again. It's going to be all right. I walked out the door and I just heard clunk, you know, that deadbolt. I scared that woman to death. She probably prayed more that hour than she had in a long, long time. My last really bad drunk I came to on the living room floor. I pushed the television set through the window. There's glass all over the floor. My wife came back to get some more of her things. And while she was there, I was trying to talk with her, trying to get her to stay and trying to reason with her. But she had had it. And as she was leaving, she reached into her purse and took out a little piece of notebook paper and just zinged it to me. And she was gone. And I unfolded the little piece of notebook paper and looked at that. And what it was a prayer. That someone had taken a pencil and written a prayer down and gave it to her, you know. And for the next 2 weeks, I just sat in that apartment and would read that prayer over and over and over again. I did not know where to go and I did not know where to turn. It was 2 weeks later that I was captured and wound up in Seminole County Jail there in Florida. And I was sick. I was really sick. I had charges out the yin yang. Every day they take me out and rain me on charges. I had charges in front of five judges. So often it comes to Alcoholics Anonymous, unwanted, unwelcome anywhere. I want to let you know that I was not unwanted. I was wanted. I was wanted in Orange County, Seminole County, Volusia County, New York, Arkansas, Missouri were very interested in me. I must have been a pretty interesting guy. And one of my sentencing judges leaned over the bench and said, I've just sentenced you to every year I can give you, and I'd give you more if I could. And you are despicable. And when I got back to my cell, I got a dictionary, and I looked that word up. It said, despicable, worthy of being despised. And I said, I knew that. I've known that all my life. I've always known that. I didn't know anything at all about being through with alcohol. But I knew one thing, that I was through with me. I'd had all me I could stand. I couldn't stand another second of me. And I think, why was I even born? Why am I here? Why do I exist? I'm not good for myself or another human being. I don't fit in anywhere. Why even live? I heard there were meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous available there in the Seminole County Jail. And remembering the understanding I'd once found at a meeting called Alcoholics Anonymous, I just thought I'd just go to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. The guy named Jerry W. would bring a meeting in once a week. And, you know, we'd go to the meeting, you know, and sit down and stuff. And Jerry would usually bring someone with him. And he would introduce this guy. Jerry would talk a little bit, and then he would introduce the guy, and the guy would get up and he'd tell his story. And he'd talk about his drinking. Then he'd talk about a solution he'd found in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I just did that week after week after week after week after week. I didn't know if AA was for me or not, but I was certainly looking for something. They shipped me over to the Orange County Jail to get some charges over there. Boy, I couldn't wait to get those. And there they had a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And so I went to that meeting. And I just walked in the room. There was a guy standing up. There was a black guy. And he got up and he was telling his story. And now this is the guy that had done time, serious time. And boy, he really got my attention. And he said that that he was working and that his family were together and they were happy. And he talked about all these wonderful things about Alcoholics Anonymous, that he was productive and that his life worked. And he didn't have to drink one day at a time. And he found a real way out, a way that was working for him. And he had the book Alcoholics Anonymous with him. And as he spoke, he would just wave that book over his head like this. And I'd look at him like, my God, that's a big book, you know. They'll never get me to read that big book. The next evening, they asked if anybody wanted to go to the library. And I wasn't a big library kind of guy. We didn't hang out at libraries. But I went to the library, you know, for no reason other than to get out of the cell. And I walked into the library, and what it was just a big room full of books. And for no reason, I turned to the left, and I walked up to the books. And right at the end of my nose was the book, Alcoholics Anonymous. And hopelessness makes that a very exciting book. And I took that book and I went back to my cell and I opened it up and I started to read. And I saw my life. I absolutely saw my life. I didn't read the whole book. I was reading in the third chapter. And I found two paragraphs about a jaywalker. And in those two paragraphs, the lights came on. The lights came. It was like a moment of illumination. I said, this is me. 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 And I continued to read through the book and I came to page 63 and I found that prayer. that I'd sat on the edge of the bed and had read for 2 weeks over and over and over again. And at that moment in my life, I guess, you know, all that I'd heard and going to all the meetings in the jail and the, you know, just the prayers I'd said, I think the combination of all that for me was that I just had a desire for sobriety. Somehow within me, I had gotten a desire to try to make AA work for me. And when they shipped me back to the Seminole County Jail, I got before Jerry and I just said, Jerry, just please tell me what to do. Tell me what to do. Tell me what to do. And Jerry said, Lee, I cannot tell you what to do, but I'll show you what I did. And Jerry pointed me again to the book Alcoholics Anonymous and said that we had a program. Jerry knew where I was going to go. There wasn't going to be 90 minutes and 90 days. He said, he was told it all. You know, you guys are going to have the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, we read that book for information, but when you do that book, you get transformation. And that's what happened to me. That's what happened to me. I want to tell you what, God's bigger than jail. I talked to some new people last night. You know, I got through Jerry. And, you know, Jerry said, Lee, I can't promise you a good job. Maybe one of these days you'll get a good job. Maybe you won't. I can't promise you a wonderful relationship. Maybe one of these days you'll have a wonderful relationship. Maybe you won't. Lee, what we can promise you, that if you'll do the things contained within the pages of this book, the book Alcoholics Anonymous, that you can have a relationship with a power greater than yourself that can make your life mighty wonderful. The new guys I talked to last night, I wish they could have been here today. They're in some house or like military treatment center or something. They couldn't be here. But I know there's some other new people in here. You know, I would get with Jerry and I'd say, Jerry, I'm a goner. I've tried everything. There's nothing that can help me. And if you're new today and you feel that way, if you've exhausted every avenue of hope, if there's no place left for you to turn, if you've used up everybody, every resource, if there's no place left for you to go, that makes you an excellent candidate for sobriety in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I would get with Jerry and I'd say, Jerry, I'm not smart enough to do this thing. I don't know how this can work for me. I've never even read a book. And let me assure you of this too. This deal is not dependent on individual skills or abilities or intelligence that you may or may not have. This deal is for everybody. This truly is God's deal. We come in here just the way we are, what we've got and a whole lot of what we don't have. We do the best that we can do, and my best was just like that. But when I applied my best to this program, God took this and He made this out of it. And I see Him do it over and over and over and over and over again. I can't explain it. I don't want to explain it. All I want to do is do it. And I'd like to encourage some of you new people to do that too. Alcoholics Anonymous will not work for people who want it. It will not work for people who need it. It will only work for people who do it. In the second foreword of the book, Alcoholics Anonymous, it said 50% of people come to Alcoholics Anonymous and really try, get sober at once. Another 25% after a few relapses can have sobriety. And the ones that would just continue to come, their lives will improve. I know a guy, he's never stayed sober over 2 years. But admit 6 months, 2 years, 1 year. But you know what? The guy makes more money I've ever seen anybody in my life. He's happy and his wife is happier today. And the guy will not stop drinking. He will not. He'll go out and get drunk again. But his life is better just because he comes to Alcoholics Anonymous. And then there's those of us that'll do anything. We'll do whatever it takes to not take that first drink. I don't ever want to be new again. I want to be in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, moving in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. For me, my recovery took place between steps 4 and 10. To me, in my opinion, that's the program of recovery of Alcoholics Anonymous. A moral house cleaning and righting of my wrongs. I don't know any other way to do it. And Jerry led me through that process the best we could do in jail. I live every day today in 10, 11, and 12. And I have a clean house. I don't know of anything that I need to do to straighten anything out today. I got busy in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous there in Seminole County Jail. And when I had my opportunity to stand before the judge, I explained to him how great I was doing in AA and how wonderful life was going to be. And he goes, well, we're going to help you, we're going to give you a little something extra to help you clean up that mess you've made. You know, and he, you know, of course gave me some time. And, you know, I look back at that today and I needed it. I needed it every day of that 2 years I spent locked up. And I got my first 2 years of sobriety in a correctional facility. And, first thing you do is you go in and receive any medical, and then they put you in your permanent camp. And it was 2 weeks since I'd been to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, or 2 weeks since I'd seen a member of Alcoholics Anonymous or spoke with anyone in AA. And when I got to my permanent camp, boy, there was a guy there mopping the floor. I looked over at him and said, boy, do you guys have AA here? And he said, yes. I said, wow. He said, they've got a meeting tonight. I said, oh boy, you know. And they put us in a, took us and put us in a cell block where we were going to be. They said, you men are all in orientation for the next 72 hours. We're going to keep you here isolated in population. Everything you do will be in here, and you won't be mixing with general population. I said, man, I want to go to that AA meeting tonight. And I was sitting there thinking about it, and I watched one guy walk over to the correctional officer and said, I need some cigarettes. I need to go to the commissary. And he said, no. I said, boy, I want to go to that AA meeting tonight. Watched another guy walk over to the correctional officer and said, I need to go to the telephone. I need to call my attorney. He said, no. I said, boy, I need to go to that meeting. And I put my head down. I said, God, I'd sure like to go to that meeting tonight. I'm just going to put it in your hands. And I got up and walked over to the correctional officer. And I said, I'm a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I need to go to that meeting tonight. And he said, well, go ahead. God will give us what we need. You know that? We don't always get what we want. God has always given me what I needed. Always. Always. My job in this deal is to want what He wants for me. You know, and I think back today, you know, about how that happened, how that officer let me go. And it wouldn't surprise me that maybe sometimes he thinks back. I can just see him right now sitting out on his porch swing smoking a cigarette. Reflecting back. I can just hear him thinking right now, why did I let that guy go? You know? But I see stuff like that happen all the time around Alcoholics Anonymous. I got very active in the meetings there in the facility I was in. We had one big meeting a week. There was always 75 or 80 guys there, and we had cake and coffee, and then the two outside female sponsors would come in. And it wasn't very long I figured out why the meetings were so popular, you know. Just good cake, I guess. But they would let me chair the meeting sometimes and let me be involved. And boy, you know, it wasn't very long at all before some of the guys and I, we got together and we said, well, we'd like to have another meeting. We ought to start another meeting, you know. And, you know, I was at Tom Eye's correctional conference there in Area 51 a couple of years ago. And, you know, after 3 days of sharing and panels and listening to speakers and talking to people between meetings, the two things that I really got out of that deal was one is, that a guy that waits until he gets out to try to do something about changing his life will not make it. And I can tell you that from personal experience. The second thing is that more meetings are needed inside our facilities. And that's what we want. We wanted another meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. So some of us got together and we said, well, we'll ask someone here that they'll be, you know, a guard or somebody, and maybe they'll help us out with this deal. So we asked everybody on the compound. And they just said, no, 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 no. And we got together and we talked. You know, they'd let 2, 3, sometimes 4 meet out on a compound. But they don't allow numbers of people to congregate. And there's good reasons for that. But the guy said, we've forgotten where we're at. We're just numbers. They're not going to do anything like that for us. And one guy said, well, hey, let's pray about it. You know, we don't know what prayer is. We only know that it is. We just started praying about it. He said, God, we'd sure like to have another meeting. We're just going to put it in your hands. A couple months later, they came to us in that department and said, you know, we thought about it, and you guys still want to have that meeting, you can have that meeting. And we said, thank you. We said, thank you. You know? And boy, we had our meeting. Man, I got some books and some chips, and found a good room and straightened the chairs and found a little literature. I named the group. I kind of felt like I was in charge. The first meeting I chaired it, and I was standing up there, and a guy said something. I said, you can't say that here. That's against tradition. He said, well, which one? I said, I don't know. It's got to be against one of them. He jumped over the table on me and was going to fire me up. It was a mess. And all that next week, I just prayed and prayed. I said, God, what am I going to do? I can't just turn this meeting over to those idiots. They'll ruin it, you know? And I kept waiting for God to give me some insight on this thing. And the next week I got there and I walked in the doorway and was standing there where the meeting was. And I was thinking, what am I going to do? And some of the guys came over to me and said, Lee, we talked about it. And we decided that if you'll sit right over there and be quiet, we'll let you stay. And they did okay, you know. The meeting went great, you know. And there's nothing on this earth at that time that meant more to me than that hour and those men and that we could be together. Let me tell you what happened to me as a result of putting into practice a program described in the pages of the book Alcoholics Anonymous. and being willing to serve in Alcoholics Anonymous just any way I could. I was out on the compound one morning. On Saturday mornings, it's real quiet on the compound. Most of the guys would sleep in. It was the only opportunity to do that, but I'd get up really early. And I prayed every day. But that was my opportunity to have a little private time. And I would get out on that compound really early. And I was out there practicing my 11th step. And I was talking to God. And I realized that I was happy. And for the first time in my life, I knew that my life was really going somewhere. And it was okay to be me. I mean, I was in prison. And I felt like $1 million. And you're not supposed to feel that way in prison. You're supposed to be discouraged. You're supposed to be filled with despair. You're supposed to be lost. You're supposed to be alone. You're supposed to know there is no hope. You're supposed to be filled with fear and filled with hate. But my roots had grasped new soil. And inside of me there was a willingness to believe that there was a power greater than me that was guiding my life and taking me to something better. I was not happy to be in prison, but I found happiness in prison because He was with me. Augustine wrote, "Thou hast made us for Thyself, O Lord, and our hearts are restless until they rest in Thee." You know, we don't seek God for what we can get. We seek God for what we can become. They suggested the day you get out, you go straight to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And the day I got out, two fellows that I'd been locked up with that were out working programs came to pick me up. And I thought they were being nice to me. I didn't know they were doing that to help themselves. And they took me straight to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I thought I had prison written across my forehead. I walked in the meeting. It was a little small discussion meeting. Everyone was sitting in a circle. I had my head down. It was my turn to share. I said, "I just got out of jail." You know, I knew they were going to say, "What? Jail? Get out. You know, you'll mess us up." But the guy chairing the meeting said, "Well, we're glad you're out of jail. And if you really mean business about doing something about your drinking, you've come to the right place." You didn't care where I'd been or what I'd done. All you cared about was what I was willing to do about my recovery and how you could help me. And that's all I've ever found in Alcoholics Anonymous, was people that wanted to help me no matter what. I've never been asked to leave a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I've never been told I was too bad that I couldn't make it here. I've always heard, "Lee, if you'll do it, it'll work for you. If you put forth the action necessary, it'll work for you. And if you don't drink today, you'll never have to take another drink, because it's always today. And if you don't drink, you can't get drunk." I went to 110 meetings my first 90 days out, 100 the next 90, and 90 the next 90. And I just lived in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. I walked to a lot of meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I rode the bicycle to a lot of meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. And people would pick me up and take me to meetings, take me into their homes and feed me dinner. A man had two coats, and that man gave me a coat. Everybody got around me and just tried to teach and introduce this program to me. Everyone wanted me to have the best chance at getting this deal that I could possibly have. You know what I did? I caused trouble immediately. I was only out a couple of weeks, and we were closing the meeting. And I felt some little tiny hand slip itself into mine, and whoa, boy, you know, I felt something I hadn't felt in a while. And after the meeting, everybody knows you're supposed to go to the Golden Lamb for coffee. You know, everybody goes to the Golden Lamb for coffee after the meetings. But that night, this woman and I, we went someplace else. And I was so dumb that I did not realize that just anything could happen if a man and a woman went off together alone. And it was that night that anything happened, you know. And I felt real good about it. The next day, you know, I got off work. I went to my meeting. I got there just as they were opening the meeting up. And, you know, I raised my head up. There were 30 people around these two big tables. And I looked down way at the other end of the table, and there was that woman. I said, "There she is," you know. And I was so happy to see her. And I realized she was crying. She looked like she was upset. And I said, "Oh, boy, something must have happened today. She's crying. She's upset. I wonder what could have happened. I was just with her last night. And everything was great, you know." So they said, "Does anyone have anything to share?" And she said, "Yes, I'd like to share. I feel like, oh, I feel like I've been used." I said, "Oh." You know what I said? "They're going to throw me out of Alcoholics Anonymous. I've blown it now. They'll never let me come back." And a little old timer there by the name of Elise looked over at her and said, "Honey, if you don't like the way it feels, don't ever do it again, you know." And probably saved my life. I don't think I could have ever come back if she hadn't said that. After the meeting, guy in the halfway house came over to me and said, Lee, how'd that feel? I said, boy, that didn't feel very good at all. I said, and he said, well, guess what? If you don't ever do that again, you'll never have to feel that way again. And boy, I wish I'd gotten that lesson the first time. I at least came up to me after the meeting and handed me the keys and said, next week you're going to open up. So she gave me a little something to do other than what I was doing. Boy, I was scared to death. I said, my God, I've got to get there early. I've got to make the coffee, you know. And whoa, boy, I was really nervous. I got there really early and set the meeting up, got everything going, you know, and it went okay. You know, everything went fine. You know what? They give you these little jobs around here, if you do pretty good, they'll give you other jobs. And other jobs, and other jobs, and other jobs. And that's been my experience in service in Alcoholics Anonymous. I heard Betty S. share a point. They suggested a sponsor. I looked around the room, everybody else had one. It looked like the popular thing to do. I certainly wanted to be popular. So I asked this fellow named Butch. Don't ever ask anybody named Butch to be your sponsor. It might be him. Don't ever ask anybody named Butch or Killer to be your sponsor. Boy, that guy was something else. I went to him once. I thought he ought to loan me a little money. He told me to shut up. He said I was stupid. He said, get down there and sit down in the front row. That's where the stupid people sit. No offense. Yeah. I know another time I went to Butch, and I thought I'd been doing pretty good. I'd gotten a piece of paper, and I wrote down everything I didn't like. And I said, I'll write down all my complaints, and I'll share this with Butch. No. And I wrote it down. You know, I went to Butch. I said, look here, Butch, I don't like this, and 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 this stinks, and look at that, boy. And he said, wow, you're not very happy with what you have here. I said, no, I'm not. He said, well, maybe you ought to just go get drunk and see how you like that. I said, well, boy, I don't want to get drunk, you know. He said, well, you're not very happy. You'll probably get drunk. So I got happy. I said, boy, this stuff isn't as bad as I thought, you know. And for me, gratitude is the hinge on which the gate of sobriety swings. I've never seen a grateful alcoholic get drunk, and never have I ever seen a person fail that thoroughly enjoyed this path. And, boy, what a path do we have here in Alcoholics Anonymous. You could never have explained to me what I was going to find when I came in here to be with you. I didn't know if I wanted what you had. I just knew I didn't want what I had. September the 12th, 1986, I was released from the penitentiary for what I know can be the last time. March the 30th, 1992, the Division of Parole and Pardons released me 15 and a half years early. That's after having spent 17 and a half years of my life in the correction system, inside or on some kind of paper, waiting to go back, knowing I was going to go back, knowing that was going to be my life. And I didn't bring anything here with me that could have produced that. I came here with a shoebox. That's what I brought with me when I came here. I came here with a shoebox with some letters and some pencils, one change of socks and one change of underwear. That's all I brought with me. But everything in life that I needed to have any success at all met me at the door when I came here. I had 11 jobs the first 18 months that I was out. I wasn't any better at that sober than I was drunk. Every job I had one thing really wrong with it, you know. They wanted me to work. Boy, I was having a terrible time. And I was going into jail one night, and a guy was coming out of the jail, and he said, you know, we were talking, he said, well, maybe you can work where I work, you know, and gave me this guy's card and said, you come in, you know, call him tomorrow, you know, and I'll put in a good word for it, you know. I said, okay. And I went into the jail meeting deal, and then later that evening I went to my meeting, and I got the meeting, I showed everybody that card. Look at this, you know, maybe I'll get this job, you know, get a job, you know. So the next day, I called this guy. He said, yes, we need some people immediately. I want you to come down here tomorrow and bring your resume. Click. And I thought, resume? Oh, man, what am I going to do with that? You know, what am I going to put on some kind of resume? This is a big mistake, you know. State prison, state prison, state prison. You know? I can't go down there. I can't do that. And I went to my meeting that night, and those guys said, did you call that fellow? I said, yes, I called him. Big mistake I almost made. They wanted a resume. They said, well, we think you ought to go down there and talk to that guy. We think you ought to go down there and tell him the truth. I said, I can't do that, you know. And they put it to me this way. We don't even want to see you again if you're not willing to go down there. I said, man, boy, what am I going to do? And I went home that night and I started praying about it. I said, God, I can't go down there. I said, well, you're going to have to go with me. If I go down there, you're going with me, you know. The next day I got up and I said, okay, we're going to go down to this place. We won't be there long, you know. I walked in that guy's office and he told me, sit over there. I sat down. He says, where's your resume? I said, I don't have a resume. He said, well, no big deal. Do you have any experience in sales? And the moment he said that, it was like a light went off in my mind. And I said, well, yeah. I've sold microwaves and stereos and cars and boats and knives and furs. And... man, I sold it all. He goes, wow, you got a lot of experience. Think I'd get you a start tomorrow? I said, yeah, man. I sold that guy's product like popcorn. You didn't have to sneak down the alley with it or keep it covered up with a blanket or hide it in the trunk of your car. You just walk up to anybody, you know. I don't think God minds at all that we have a little something and do pretty good here in Alcoholics Anonymous. I take God with me everywhere I go today. I'd rather walk in the dark with God than walk alone in the light. It is better to walk with God by faith than to walk alone by sight. Listen to this. I've become a regular guy. I have a job. I have a car. I live somewhere. I have clothes. I went back to school. I went down to the intergroup office one day and they asked me if I wanted to be on the service committee. I volunteered for the service committee. Man, after a year on the service committee, I said, man, this is important. I must be important, you know. This is valuable. I had value. Boy, I felt so good about myself. I said, I'll go to school, you know. I went back to school and got an education. I heard a woman in a meeting once, she was sharing, she said, I woke up at 4 o'clock in the morning and I was so excited about what I do for a living. I love it so much that I just laid there and I couldn't go back to sleep. And I just thought about going to work, going to work, going to work. I said, man, I don't feel that way. And I was praying about it. I said, God, isn't there anything I would like to do that might be something good that would be helpful to others or something, you know, that I could, you know, something for me. And, you know, when I first came into AA, I heard a guy say in a meeting once, if you take care of God's business, he'll take care of your business. I said, well, God, I don't know anything to do. But I'll just work with these new guys, and I'll take every job in AA I can take, and I'll just stay as busy in AA as I can, you know. My experience is this. If you take care of God's business, he'll give you a business because he did that for me. And I love what I do today. Sometimes I wake up at 4 o'clock in the morning, and I'm so excited about going to work that I just lay there and can't go back to sleep. That happens to me about once a month. I love what I do so much. Sometimes I have a girlfriend. Sometimes I have serenity. You don't always get both of those. I asked an old timer once if he thought sex was dirty. He said, only if you're doing it right, you know. I said, thanks for clearing that up. I'm going to share a couple of my amends with you, and I'm going to close. There's several areas of the program that I see the guys I work with seem to have a lot of trouble with. One's the God thing. It's just the idea of God. A lot of guys I work with, they can't handle that at all. And I like what Dr. Bob says about that. If you're an atheist or an agnostic, a skeptic, or have any other form of intellectual pride that might prevent you from accepting what we have to offer here, I feel sorry for you. It's a pretty easy door that we need to open up, just the barest minimum. I mean, it's a door that we just have to crack open just a tiny, tiny bit. You know, your own conception. I mean, you can't have it your way in this deal, any area but that. You can have it your way. Anything you want to believe or are willing to believe is sufficient to make a start. You know, in Bill's story, Bill said his newfound friend. That's where Bill started. And by the time he got to the fifth chapter, Bill's higher power had become his director, his employer, his principal, and his father. So Bill had grown. So we start from where we're at. Whatever's good enough, that's where you start. But you got to start somewhere or be willing to. Another area is this step. Sometimes guys just don't want to really get down to business with that. And it's a difficult thing to come in and really tell the truth. But one of the errors I was having trouble in was the ninth step. You know, my sponsor didn't let me lay around very long at all. He said, if you're never going to stay sober unless you get down to business and clean up your past, Lee. And so he sat down with me and we made an eight-step list, you know. And And I looked at that and I said, my God, you know, how am I ever going to repay whole communities or cities, you know, for all the harm that I've caused? And I felt overwhelmed. So he just gave me the boot and said, get out there and get at it, you know. You start. You start with the first one or the second one or the third one and you do it. And so I just, one day I grabbed the bull by the horns and I went out and tried to clean up the mess I'd made. But, you know, there were several things on my list that I had no idea what I was going to do anything about. You know, my father was dead. My father had been killed. And I couldn't go to my father. And the book Alcoholics Anonymous clearly says that there are people we cannot see. And we write them an honest letter. And you know, and that's what I did. I did exactly what the book says. Is that what the book says? That I did what the book said. And you know what? That's good enough. If the book says it, it's good enough. And I went to my father's grave with an honest letter. And I read the letter to my father. And every time I'm in Arkansas, I visit my father's grave. And there was a time in my life when I didn't have good thoughts about my father. When I thought about my father, I felt like I'd been done wrong or some kind of something like that. But I don't feel that way anymore. When I think of my father today, I think, you know, I remember my father when I was a little child getting on his knees and praying with me and trying to teach me how to pray. I think, man, I had a great father. Few people have a father like that. And so this whole thing is turned around just as a result of following the instructions in the book with my father. The another amends I had, I'd committed a lot of crimes. I'd committed many, many, many crimes. I had no idea what I would do about that. And I was talking to my sponsor, and he referred me to a guy who'd been sober a long, long, long time. And so I went and talked to old Charlie L., who passed on a couple of years ago with 52 years of sobriety. And I said, Charlie, what do I do about this? The book says maybe we need to go back to jail or something like that. And Charlie looked at it and thought about it. And he goes, you know, Lee, I don't think you need to go back to jail. There's other ways to clean this stuff up. So what I did, there was a guy that had his name on the board. He wanted to come to meetings. He just needed a ride. And so I started picking Saul up and taking Saul to meetings. Now, Saul's last drunk, he lost both his legs. That's what happened to him the last time he had a drink. And what you do is you go and you get, pick him up, and you put him in the front seat, and you wrap the wheelchair up, and you put it in the trunk, and then you go to the meeting, and then you get the wheelchair out and put him in it, do that in reverse. And I first started doing that, I said, boy, this is kind of difficult. This is kind of tough. But you know, after 30 days, I couldn't wait to get over there and pick that guy up. And after 9 months, it was like the richest part of my life. I mean, we were fighting over getting that guy and taking him to meetings, me and the other guys. You know, we'd have the meeting, we'd be there, and they'd read that third chapter. We were like men who have lost our legs. All the new people would lean over and look at Saul, you know. And he'd share the same thing every week. This is what happened to me last time I took a drink, boy. And there's no telling how many people he saved with that. You know, what a powerful, powerful message that guy had. The another area was my family. You know, my grandparents never turned their back on me. They always did everything in their power to try to help me and try to save me. But the rest of my family had watched me hurt the two people that loved me more in my life, more than anyone else in my life, over and over and over and over and over and over and over again. And, you know, they were very skeptical of my recovery, and they really didn't know what to think about me at all. But when I would, a year after I got out, I flew to Arkansas to be with my grandparents and to try to start cleaning up some of the mess I'd made there. And, you know, I'd come in on a Friday, and Saturday morning I'd get out, and I'd go out in the community. And I'd visit a place I used to work, I'd steal from, or some place I used to live that I destroyed or something, and try to do something about that. But in the afternoon, I would visit my older relatives who could not get out, and I have a handicapped cousin, and I'd visit him. Saturday night, I'd go to a meeting, and Sunday, I'd spend all day with my grandparents. I'd give them all day and come back home. And after about 3 years of being out, I was doing that, and I'd come in on a Friday, get up on Saturday morning, visit my older relatives who couldn't get out, make a couple of amends. Saturday night, go to a meeting. On Sunday, maybe one of my aunts would call, or one of my uncles would come by and visit with me or something like that. I'd been out for 8 years, and I'd been visiting them for 7 years. I was 10 years sober. I flew into Arkansas on a Friday. On Saturday morning, I visited my older relatives that couldn't get out, my handicapped cousin, went to a meeting on Saturday night. But on Sunday morning, 40 members of my family came over to my grandparents' home to be with me. One of my uncles came over to me and said, Lee, there's just something about you that makes people want to be together. And I thought to myself, I know what it is. it's Alcoholics Anonymous. I really appreciate what Alcoholics Anonymous has done for me. I cannot fit AA into my life. AA is my life. Sometimes I've said that and people come to me and say, boy, it's not my life. It's a part of my life. I don't want to ever make it my life. I say, well, good for you, you know. But this is what I want. And I want to go anywhere Alcoholics Anonymous will take me. I want to close with a story. It's one that helped me a lot for anyone here that may be struggling with this higher power thing. In 1989, a father in Armenia walked his son to school and took him to the steps of the school and dropped him off and walked several blocks to where he was working. Now, that day in Armenia, they had an earthquake, and they do not build buildings in Armenia the way they build them in California. They build them out of rock and stone and brick. And that city was absolutely destroyed. And that father miraculously drug himself out of the rubble of that building and ran those blocks to where that school had been, past fires, and emergency vehicles, people screaming. Got to the school, and it was just a pile of stone. And he ran to the top of the pile and started throwing rocks and throwing bricks and screaming out his son's name, Armand, 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 Armand. And people would come to him and say, let us help you. You're bleeding. You're in shock. Let us do something for you. And he'd say, help me find my son. Help me find my son. They'd say, he's delirious. We can't do anything for him. And they'd go help someone else. 36 hours later, he was still there screaming his son's name and throwing rocks and throwing bricks. After 36 hours, he heard something. He said, Armand, is it you? He heard, yes, Father, it's me. He said, son, are you all right? He said, yes, Father, I'm all right. There are 13 of us in here. I told them that if my father is alive, he will not rest until he saves me. And when he helps me, he'll help you too. You new people, I've got good news. Here in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, we have a father. In the fifth chapter, Bill wrote, he is the Father, we are His children. In the closing of Dr. Bob's story, Dr. Bob wrote, your Heavenly Father will never let you down. Here in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, you have a Heavenly Spiritual Father who will not rest until He saves you. He will not rest until He reaches you. And after He's helped you, He's going to use you to help somebody else. I love all of you, and thank you for helping me stay sober today.